Not all monsters are myths.
Michigan Monsters.
This is Michigan Monsters. A true crime gothic.
Oh, hi. I heard you guys have been looking for me. I'm here. And after an unexpectedly long hiatus, I am ready to discuss some more Michigan-centric true crime with you. Are you ready for it? A lot has changed since we last talked, clearly not my Swifty status, but everything else pretty much in my life, I'm sure in your lives as well, and just in the world in general. But we can talk about all that later. One big change for the podcast that we do need to talk about upfront is that it has a new name again. I do still feel like changing the name from So Dead was the right move. It didn't really fit the vibe of the show anymore. Once the show became, you know, a bit more serious, a bit more in-depth, So Dead didn't really fit. But Violent Ends just never really settled in like I wanted it to either. I wanted to love it, tried to love it, but I just didn't. So I'm so sorry. I know it's confusing, but I promise this is the last time. I don't know what that just was. Third time's a charm, maybe, hopefully. Yeah, it's gotta be. So this is actually what I wanted to change the name of the show to the last time I changed it, but I was so hesitant at that time to marry myself to only covering Michigan cases forever. But let's be honest, I'm never going to talk about anything else. So I think we all know that. So yeah, without further ado, welcome to Michigan Monsters. I'm your host, Jen Carpenter. Let's start this new era the same way we've started every other season of the show, by doing a deep dive into the case of one of Michigan's many serial killers. Today, we're going to talk about a case that may sound familiar. Lansing, Michigan, my hometown, and I know many of yours as well. The city is gripped in fear as elderly women are being attacked, raped, and murdered in their own homes, often in broad daylight. The anonymous suspect, a young black man. If this doesn't conjure up memories of Matthew Macon's reign of terror in the early 2000s, it should. But what if I told you that the city of Lansing has had not just one, but two serial killers, and that both times they were young black men preying on elderly white women? It was a weird thing to happen once, because that is not your typical demographic for a serial killer or a serial killer's victim, right? But twice in the same smallish Midwestern city? Weird isn't the word for it. On August 28, 2007, the Lansing Police Department responded to a call from a 56-year-old woman who'd been attacked in her home on Jones Street in the middle of the day and left for dead by a young black man that knocked on her door under the guise of looking for work. Unbeknownst to her, she'd just survived a serial killer. 27-year-old Matthew Macon was arrested later that day and was eventually charged with the murders of several Lansing women. Exactly 27 years earlier, when Macon was just shy of a year old, an eerily similar scene occurred. On August 28, 1980, the Lansing Police Department responded to a call from a 76-year-old woman who'd been attacked in her home on Alfred Avenue in the middle of the day and left for dead by a young black man. She told police she'd been outside doing yard work, and when she went back inside, she found the man standing in her living room with a rope that he used to strangle her to the point of unconsciousness. When she woke up, he was gone. Unbeknownst to her, she'd just survived a serial killer. Not Matthew Macon, obviously, but his predecessor. In both August 28th attacks, in 1980 and in 2007, authorities were alarmed. More so in 2007, as Matthew Macon's rampage was nearing its end and police knew they were looking for a serial killer. In 1980, the true horror of what was happening wasn't quite as clear, but the LPD knew something was up, because this wasn't the first attack of its kind, and it wouldn't be the last. 3 weeks earlier, on August 7th, which ironically aligns with the date that the second body in Matthew Macon's 2007 Reign of Terror was discovered, a woman in her 70s who lived in a senior housing complex on Lansing's west side found a young black man hiding in her apartment when she returned home from running errands. He used a rope to strangle her to the point of unconsciousness, and when she woke up, he was gone. Nothing was taken in either the August 7th or the August 28th attack, so robbery wasn't believed to be a motive. Obviously, the Lansing Police Department, 1980s version, assumed that these two attacks were probably related and were actively investigating when, a couple months later, things took a turn. On Sunday, October 19th, 1980, the Lansing Police Department responded to a call from the brother of 77-year-old Edna Reichert, who was concerned that something had happened to his sister. Edna was a widow who lived alone in the Wesley Place home on Lansing's west side that she'd shared with her husband until the day he died in 1976, just a few years earlier. The grandmother of five had made plans for her brother to pick her up on Sunday afternoon and drive her to the airport, just a few miles from her house, for a trip to Oklahoma. But when he arrived to get her, she was nowhere to be found. So he called police, and together they began to canvass the neighborhood. Neighbors told officers they'd last seen Edna around 5 p.m. the night before, out on her nightly walk around the safe, family-friendly neighborhood, which nobody ever thought twice about her taking those walks alone because it was a good neighborhood. Just an hour after the search for Edna began, it ended. Her brother was the first to spot her body in a creek just south of Horse Brook Elementary School near her home. She was partially nude, a rope tied around her neck, with her upper body submerged in the creek and the lower half of her body sticking out of the water. She'd been strangled and sexually assaulted. Evidence suggested she'd been snatched during her evening walk from Tecumseh Park, then dragged through a wooded area to the creek. The once quiet Northside neighborhood was shocked. Police received hundreds of tips, but every potential suspect, including a Sexton High School student who was, at one point, their top suspect, was ruled out. The man they were searching for, based on descriptions given by surviving victims, was a clean-shaven black man in his early 20s, between 5'8" and 5'10", about 150 pounds. A few weeks after Edna's murder, so we've got two attacks and now a murder, a few weeks after that, on November 9th, 52-year-old Owita Sweet fought for her life, and won, when a young black man followed her home from the Kroger on Grand River on the city's north side and tried to strangle her with a rope. Owita managed to grab a frying pan and she hit her attacker with it. He easily wrestled the pan out of her hands, struck her with it several times, and then fled the scene. Luckily, Owita was not severely injured. Unluckily, authorities were no closer to finding their guy, so two attacks, a murder, and now a third attempted, sort of attack, but a third attempted attack that was thwarted by the potential victim. And then just 4 months after the murder of Edna Reichert, evil struck again. On Sunday, February 15th, 1981, the Lansing Police Department responded to a call on the city's west side, specifically the 1,000 block of West St. Joseph, near my alma mater and yours, Sexton High School. Like a scene straight out of a horror movie, a paperboy on his bicycle was making his Sunday rounds when he spotted a body in the bushes at one of the homes on his route. The body belonged to 81-year-old widow Edith Crissett, who, just like all of these other victims, lived alone and had been strangled and sexually assaulted, presumably in the middle of the day. Edith, a former librarian who loved to read, regularly attended First Baptist Church, and was known for her punctuality, was last seen by a neighbor the previous Wednesday, February 11th. The Thursday paper was inside Edith's house, which was immaculate and showed no signs of a struggle or ransacking or anything like that. But the Friday and Saturday papers were still sitting on the porch, and when a neighbor stopped by on Sunday morning to pick Edith up for church, she didn't answer the door. A little while later, the paperboy arrived and made the grisly discovery of Edith's partially clad body in the bushes, a rope tied around her neck. Based on this timeline, it was estimated that on either Friday the 13th or on Valentine's Day, which was Saturday, Edith was grabbed as she returned home from an outing and killed in her own yard before she even made it into the house. Due to the similarities between the three attacks and now two murders of elderly women that occurred over a span of just 6 months, authorities believe that all of these attacks were very likely connected. On April 7th, 1981, which was a Wednesday, Lansing police were called to the home of 88-year-old Lottie Griffith, who lived on the 200 block of West Maple on the city's north side in the Old Town District. Lottie had been outside washing her car a little before 11 a.m. At one point, she went back inside to refill her bucket, and she was attacked from behind as she stood at the sink by a man who had followed her into her home. She screamed for help as she was thrown to the ground, and thankfully, she was not home alone, so her cry for help was heard. Her 60-year-old son, Denman, ran into the kitchen from the living room, and he found a young black man between 5'7" and 6 foot tall, about 145 pounds, wearing a black leather or pleather jacket and maroon-colored trousers, standing over his nearly 90-year-old mother, holding a rope. The two men stared at one another for a silent moment before the attacker fled, and Denman called the police. The good news was that Lottie was not seriously injured. The bad news was that even though authorities flooded the area as soon as the call came in, the widow hunter escaped again. Quick side note about Lottie. She fully recovered from the attack and she lived another decade after her brush with a serial killer. She died on July 19, 1992, at the age of 99, less than 2 weeks before her 100th birthday. The May 7, 1981 edition of the Lansing State Journal ran a profile of the killer, provided by Michigan State Police Lieutenant Daryl Pope, a sex crimes expert. Profiling was still kind of new at the time. But according to Lieutenant Pope, they were looking for a man who was 21 years old at the most, but probably still in high school, a loner who was unable to relate to peers, especially sexually with females, had poor school attendance, was possibly in special education, and would be known by teachers as a daydreamer. He had to have a rope to commit his crimes, possibly indicating he was beaten with a rope as a child. He would follow that well-known serial killer trope of being a bedwetter who liked to torture animals and set fires. He would be afraid of older black women because of early domination by black women. He would live close to where the crimes were happening. He was or had at one time been a window peeker, particularly at older women. He may have had physical contact with older white women, such as accidental bumpings. I have no idea what that means, but this was what was in the article. And in a chilling final prediction, Pope suggested that this perp would strike again. And a little over a month later, he did. June 26, 1981 was a Friday. Just after 1 p.m., Lansing police were called to the Allen Street home of 72-year-old Violet Thornton on the city's east side. She told them that a young black man with a slim build and a short afro-style haircut had broken into her home in the middle of the afternoon and strangled her with a nylon stocking to the point of unconsciousness. When she awoke, she called 911. No. Not 911. She did not call 911. I've had to correct that so many times already this story. Because we're still in 1981, and 911 did not start as a statewide thing until the mid-80s. So she called whatever that 4-7-digit number was to get her through to the police at that time. Not 911, FYI. So Violet had been sexually assaulted, but over $300 was missing from her home. So this time, there was a robbery, which was unlike the rest of the times. An hour and a half later, another cry for help. Literally, 46-year-old Marvelline Davis, who lived on the 300 block of North Logan Street downtown, which is now known as Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, ran out into the street and flagged down a motorcycle officer for help. just to real quick draw another parallel with Lansing's other serial killer case that we keep talking about, Matthew Macon, this happened on the same street less than a half a mile from the house that Matthew Macon lived in during his summer of terror in 2007. It's getting weird, right? Miss Davis told the officer that she'd gone to check on an elderly neighbor who lived alone because she hadn't seen her out and about that day yet, and she heard screams coming from the woman's garage. So Officer Brian Smitherman followed the woman to 333 North Logan Street, where he found a youthful-looking black man strangling 83-year-old Pearl Robertson. The man surrendered and was taken into custody. The man, it turned out, was not young at all, but 52 years old. He was 52-year-old Andrew Kendrick, Pearl's next-door neighbor. He was also, for some reason, out on parole for a first-degree murder conviction after initially being sentenced to life. So he shouldn't have even been out and about, but for some reason he was. While Kendrick was not the teenager that authorities thought they were looking for, he had been in trouble with the law since his own teen years and was well known to authorities. When he was arrested, he had a .22 caliber revolver on him, which he'd used to threaten Pearl when he first approached her in her garage. Through lab testing, this weapon was connected to a different murder of an elderly woman in Lansing earlier that year. One that we haven't talked about yet because initially police did not think it was connected. On March 17th, 1981, so just a month after the Valentine's Day murder of Edith Crissette, 59-year-old Rita Asif was found dead in a downtown office building by her own nephew, a Lansing police officer responding to a report of a possible burglary at the Kelly Services building on Grand Avenue, where Rita was the manager. Rita arrived for work that morning just before 6:30. She was robbed, beaten, and shot with, forensics would later prove, the same gun that Andrew Kendrick had on him when he was arrested. At least one witness reported seeing a clean-shaven, neatly dressed young black man about 5'8 and 160 pounds fleeing the scene. This description fits both the elusive widow hunter that authorities were looking for and Andrew Kendrick, who was caught attacking a woman in the same way so many others had been attacked over the past year. And he had the gun on him that was used to kill Rita Asif. So was this it? Was this a coincidence or was Andrew Kendrick the widow hunter? While detectives worked on figuring that all out, Kendrick was charged with armed robbery, carrying a firearm during the commission of a felony, and carrying a concealed weapon for the June 26th attack on Pearl Robertson. That case was pretty cut and dry. He was quite literally caught in the act. Bond was set at $300,000 and his preliminary examination was scheduled for July. By the time that July court date rolled around, the ballistic report had come in and he'd also been charged with second-degree murder in the Rita Asif case. Kendrick's trial began on December 1, 1981 and ended 10 days later in a mistrial with a hung jury. After the case was dismissed, jurors told reporters that the prosecution failed to prove that Kendrick had the gun used to kill Rita Asif back in March when she was killed, that it could have changed hands plenty of times between that day and the day Kendrick was arrested with the gun 3 months later. It's not like it was legally purchased and registered in his name. He could have found it, borrowed it, bought it on the street. So while the gun is the one that killed Rita, there was no proof that Kendrick was the person in possession of it at the time. At least that's how the jurors felt. Either way, Andrew Kendrick wouldn't ever be a free man. Prior to the charges for the attack on Pearl Robertson, which Kendrick pled guilty to and was sentenced to 10 to 15 years for, and the murder of Rita Asif, which ended in a hung jury, Kendrick had already been convicted of murder and was sentenced to life and then, for some reason, granted parole. So because he was out on parole during the attack on Pearl Robertson, his parole was revoked and his life sentence was reinstated. So he was already going back to prison for life, plus 10 to 15, without even having any time tacked on for the murder of Rita Asif. So Andrew Kendrick would no longer be a threat to the women of Lansing, or anyone else, aside from maybe his fellow inmates. But the question remained, Was he the widow hunter? Was this nightmare over? Unfortunately, not. On Thursday, July 2nd, 1981, 72-year-old Greta Norwood, who lived on Francis Street on Lansing's east side, awoke from a mid-afternoon nap to find a young black man standing over her. She fled from her home screaming for help, which caught the attention of neighbors. The widow hunter was on the prowl once again. Police flooded the neighborhood, and based on a description of the suspect seen running near the home, they arrested an 18-year-old boy by the name of Michael Harris. Harris was charged with breaking and entering and released on bond. He was then arrested again 2 weeks later for breaking into an elderly woman's home at 1134 North Logan Street. Harris pled guilty to breaking and entering in the Norwood case and was sentenced to 4 years probation. The charges for the second B&E over on Logan Street were dropped because, according to the Ingham County prosecutor, that sentence would have run concurrently with the first one and there just wasn't a point. At the time, it was said that he was being looked at but not considered a strong suspect in the widow hunter attacks. He had, though, once been a primary suspect in Edna Reichert's murder, the very first murder, but he was later eliminated, although the State Journal did not specify what it was that eliminated him at the time. It is of note here that neither of the cases Michael Harris was arrested for and subsequently pled guilty to involved violence. Neither of those women were injured. These were just breaking and entering charges. But it was still a young black man breaking into an elderly white woman's home in the middle of the day. So, tomato, tomato, right? There's some things that point to him being the guy, but police didn't really think he was the guy. So, here, we've got all of these attacks and murders on elderly women, two different men arrested for little pieces of this puzzle, but not believed to be connected to the bigger picture, and the city of Lansing just living in absolute terror. I cannot even imagine, because Matthew Macon's reign of terror was just a couple of months, and that was awful. I lived through it. I remember it very vividly. I was in my late 20s when that happened. That was just a couple months. It was one summer. This has been now going on for a year and a half, and it's about to get worse. On Monday, November 2nd, 1981, the Lansing Police Department responded to a call from Catherine and Rexford Bowser, who were concerned about Catherine's mother, 77-year-old widow Ula Curdy. They'd been trying to reach her by phone all day to no avail. So shortly after 6 p.m., they drove to her home and found the back door hanging open. Instead of entering the home, they contacted authorities. A police officer arrived on scene about 10 minutes later, and he entered the home Ula had lived in for the past 40-some years with her husband, who had just died earlier that year. The officer found Ula's body on her dining room floor. She'd been strangled, beaten, sexually assaulted, and robbed. She'd last been seen by a neighbor the previous day, November 1st, around 10 a.m., out raking leaves. Almost everything about her murder was reminiscent of the murders of Edna Reichert and Edith Crissett, except for one thing. Ula also had puncture wounds on her neck, made with a knife from her own kitchen. While these wounds weren't fatal, they were different. This hadn't happened with the other victims. Whoever this monster was, he was escalating. And less than a month later, he killed again. Denise Swanson was Ula Curdy's neighbor. She lived on Glen Street, just three blocks from Ula's home on Glen Rose. 80-year-old Denise was a General Motors retiree and a member of the council at Grace Lutheran Church. She was a mother, a grandmother, a great-grandmother, and a widow. On Monday, November 30th, 1981, Denise's neighbors called police because they were worried about the elderly woman who lived alone in the home she'd shared with her husband. Understandably, the neighborhood was still on edge following Ula Curdy's death just a few weeks earlier, so when Denise's Monday morning paper was still sitting on her porch that evening, with her car in the driveway suggesting she'd been home all day, neighbors grew concerned enough to call police and ask for a wellness check. I feel like such a bad neighbor reading this because I feel like I wouldn't notice anything amiss at any of my neighbor's houses unless it was fully engulfed in flames. That's how situationally aware I am of what's going on around me. Officers arrived at the home and found Denise's partially clad body in her upstairs bedroom. She'd been beaten, sexually assaulted, strangled, robbed, and had the same type of superficial cuts on her neck as Ula Kurdi. Not fatal, but a concerning deviation from the prior attacks. Something else that was different this time? Lansing Police Chief Richard Gleason told the Lansing State Journal that they were 98% sure they knew who their guy was, but they didn't have enough evidence to charge him. Ingham County Prosecutor Peter Houck wasn't quite that confident and wouldn't commit to 98% certainty, but he did say that they had a strong suspect after this last murder. But with nothing more than circumstantial evidence against him, they couldn't make an arrest. So they put this man under 24-hour surveillance until he left the Lansing area and moved back home to his home state of Illinois in January of 1982. So after this last murder of Denise Swanson, they were like, listen, we think we know who's doing this. We can't charge him, but we're going to watch him. And then they did that until he moved out of state. And the attacks did stop when he left. Denise Swanson's November 30th, 1981 murder was the last known Widow Hunter attack. Over the course of 15 months, from 1980 to 1981, over a dozen elderly women were attacked, five of them killed, in this city of Lansing. Pearl Robertson's attacker was behind bars, and Rita Asif's murder was not believed to be connected, but that still leaves several attacks and four murders that were possibly slash probably related. Almost all of the women lived alone in that area of Lansing where the West Side, North Side, and Downtown meet. All four of the murdered women were widows. All four had been sexually assaulted and strangled in or near their own homes in broad daylight. Most of them had been robbed, and the last two, closest both geographically and time-wise, had superficial knife wounds on their necks. But these were just the attacks in Lansing. There were other similar attacks happening around the state at the same time. On January 8, 1982, police found the body of 91-year-old Florence Bell in her Ypsilanti home near the Eastern Michigan University campus, about 90 miles southeast of Lansing. She'd been sexually assaulted and her throat had been slashed. So, no strangulation like was seen in all of the Lansing cases, but in those last two homicides, Ula Kurdi and Denise Swanson, they did have knife wounds to the neck, almost like the killer was trying something new. Florence Bell, sadly, was no stranger to violence. In May of 1980, so less than 2 years earlier, Florence was one of three elderly women who were brutally raped and beaten in their homes near the EMU campus. Those crimes were never solved, but of course authorities made the connection immediately and they considered that perhaps the same man had come back a year and a half later to finish the job. And they did have a suspect. 24-year-old David E. Brown of Grand Rapids had been convicted of assault with intent to murder for the September 1980 attack on an elderly woman in her Grand Rapids home. He was sentenced to 10 to 25 years for attempted murder and 10 to 30 years for the associated burglary. Pause. Question. 10 to 25 years for the attempted murder and 10 to 30 years for the burglary. Why did the burglary have a longer sentence than the attempted murder? Riddle me that real quick. No, never mind. Don't answer because our criminal justice system is so broken. We all know that, right? In October of 1981, David E. Brown began complaining of fainting spells in prison, and so he was taken to the University Hospital in Ann Arbor, where he escaped custody on Halloween night, like a fucking horror movie. And then a couple months later, Florence Bell was dead. If you're not familiar with the area, Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti are right next to each other, so the hospital he escaped from was not far at all from Florence Bell's home, and the attack on her was similar to the attack that he had been convicted of in Grand Rapids. Are you guys confused yet? I should have probably told you to get out a notepad or like set up one of those bulletin boards with the red stringy things, because it's about to get even more confusing. Real quick here, we're going to completely destroy my timeline, as well as the thing I just said about the Lansing murder stopping with the November 1981 death of Denise Swanson. Because just 6 weeks after Florence Bell was found dead in her bedroom with her throat slashed, showing signs of a brutal sexual assault, an eerily similar scene unfolded back in Lansing. And the degree to which detectives went to unconnect this one from the other attacks is kind of a bit wild. So we were in Lansing for like a year and a half. We moved on to Ypsilanti, but now we're right back in Lansing a few weeks after the first Ypsilanti murder. It's Saturday, February 27th, 1982. The body of 77-year-old Daisy Lou Sneed was found in the bedroom of her home at 1123 West Washtenaw Avenue on Lansing's west side. A friend stopped by just after 7 p.m. to check on her after not being able to reach her all day, and he found her lying in a pool of blood. She'd been sexually assaulted, her throat slashed. She'd been last seen around 8 p.m. the night before when friends dropped her off at home, so there was about a 24-hour window in which she could have been attacked. Authorities were very quick to, repeatedly, say that her murder was not connected to the murders of all of these other Lansing women, the most recent of which had been less than 3 months prior. Why did they feel like it wasn't connected? Well, according to detectives, the cases were nothing alike. The other women had been strangled, whereas Daisy Lou Sneed had been stabbed, even though, in the most recent attacks, the victims did have stab wounds to the neck, they just weren't what killed them. The other women had been sexually assaulted, whereas there was no sign of such violence being inflicted upon Miss Sneed. Except, that wasn't actually true. In reality, the only difference between Daisy Lou Sneed and the other victims was that she was black and they were white. Daisy Lou never married, never had kids, but she was active in her church, close with her siblings, and doted on her nieces and nephews. The family always believed that her murder was connected to the others, but authorities at the time were adamant that it was not. Now, hindsight is 20/20, and when Daisy Lou Sneed was murdered, authorities were unaware of the Florence Bell murder a few weeks earlier in Ypsilanti, which was almost identical. But given that the killer was escalating in Lansing by stabbing his last couple of victims, and given that we're about to tie the Lansing widow murders and the Ypsilanti widow murders together in a few minutes here, I wouldn't be surprised if there is a connection to this Daisy Lou Sneed murder. In fact, I'd be more surprised if there wasn't. But let's go back to Ypsilanti. Several months after the back-to-back murders of Florence Bell and Daisy Lou Sneed, on September 29th, 1982, the body of 85-year-old Marjorie Upson was found in her Ypsilanti home when her daughter and granddaughter stopped by to check on her after not being able to reach her by phone. She'd been strangled and sexually assaulted. Her house, which was just blocks from Florence Bell's house, had been ransacked. 2 days later, on October 1st, neighbors found the body of 84-year-old Louise Kobnick on the kitchen floor of her Ann Arbor home. She had been strangled and sexually assaulted. That brought to three in and around Ann Arbor the number of elderly women living alone who'd been sexually assaulted and murdered in their own homes in broad daylight, all in 10 months' time. David E. Brown, the convict that escaped from an Ann Arbor hospital right before the attacks began, remained a suspect. But authorities were also now in contact with the Lansing Police Department, where eerily similar unsolved attacks had occurred the year before, so they're starting to piece this puzzle together now. A few days after the Ann Arbor murder on October 4th, David E. Brown had been arrested in San Bernardino, California for the beating death of a 93-year-old woman. Turned out, he'd been in California since right after his escape, so he could not be the man who had killed Florence, Marjorie, and Louise after all. Or Daisy, if we're adding her to our list, and I feel like we should. When the attacks and murders on elderly women in Lansing stopped abruptly, the nightmare wasn't over. It had just moved south to Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor. Well, the same thing happened again. The attacks in that area stopped abruptly after the murder of Louise Kobnick, but they started up again in another Michigan town, Jackson. If you're looking at Michigan on a map, Lansing, Jackson, and Ann Arbor make almost a perfect L shape. Lansing is at the top of the L, goes straight down about 40 miles to Jackson, then due east another 40 miles to Ann Arbor. So far enough apart that the communities about to be victimized weren't necessarily on high alert when the danger first reached their town, but close enough together that law enforcement officials in all three cities were now in close communication and feared that they were searching for the same man, who was not David E. Brown, not Andrew Kendrick, and not this random teenager that they had tied to a couple of break-ins but no attacks. On October 27, 1982, just over 3 weeks after the Ann Arbor murder, an 81-year-old woman was attacked in her home by an intruder. She was strangled and pushed down a flight of stairs, rendering her unconscious. When she came to, the man was gone and her house had been ransacked. Just over a week later, on November 4th, a 71-year-old woman was raped and strangled and left for dead in her Jackson home, but also survived. And then on December 4th, 1982, a 68-year-old woman was raped, strangled, beaten, and robbed in her Jackson home. The following day, a suspect in all three of those attacks who'd been identified by witnesses following the first attack, but hadn't yet been located, was arrested at the Interfaith Shelter in Jackson, a temporary residence for men experiencing homelessness. He was 19-year-old Michael Harris, formerly of Lansing and Ann Arbor. Not the escaped convict from Grand Rapids, or the man that the Lansing police chief was once 98% sure was responsible, but a kid who'd been suspected and subsequently cleared in the very first murder. The details of this next part are a bit sketchy because they come from Wikipedia, and the Wikipedia page for this guy was very clearly written by someone who either supports Michael Harris or is Michael Harris, and there's not really a citation for them. But this was the only place that I found any sort of background on him, so just take this info here with a grain of salt. Michael Darnell Harris was born on March 7th, 1963 in Muskegon Heights, Michigan, which is over on the west side of the state along Lake Michigan. He came from a good family, and in 1973, when Michael was 10, his mother landed a high-paying job at the VA hospital in Ann Arbor, and the family relocated. His mother got married, and Michael and his new stepfather soon began to clash. Michael claimed that his stepfather was aggressive and abusive, so as a teenager, Michael dropped out of school and ran away from home, living on friends' couches and in shelters. In 1980, he left Ann Arbor and moved to Lansing with his mother. The attacks on elderly women started soon after, when Michael was just 17. That first attack on August 7, 1980, occurred at the Mount Vernon Senior Housing Facility, which was located on the 3300 block of North Waverly Road. Michael, at the time, was living in an apartment on the 3200 block of North Waverly Road. So 3300, 3200, right next to each other. While in Lansing, Michael fathered a daughter, struggled to gain footing financially, was in and out of jail and in and out of homeless shelters before eventually leaving the area near the end of 1981, which, coincidentally, is when the attacks in Lansing stopped. He returned to the Ann Arbor area where he'd grown up, and the attacks started right back up there. In the fall of 1982, he moved to Jackson, and coincidentally, right at that time, the attacks in Ann Arbor stopped, but the attacks in Jackson began. And most ironically of all, once Michael Harris was finally arrested in December of 1982, the attacks stopped altogether. After 2 full years of terror, 7, possibly 8 murder victims and over a dozen sexual assault victims, countless dead-end leads and red herrings, authorities in Lansing, Jackson, Ann Arbor, and Ypsilanti were confident that they finally had their man. But did they? On Monday, December 6, 1982, 19-year-old Michael Darnell Harris was charged in Jackson with assault with intent to commit murder, first-degree criminal sexual conduct, and breaking and entering. He was held on a $100,000 bond. By the time the news made headlines a few days later, he was also the prime suspect in the attacks and murders of over a dozen elderly women in Lansing, Ypsilanti, Ann Arbor, and Jackson. A week later, on December 14th, Harris's final victim had recovered enough to attend a court hearing, during which she picked him out of a lineup. On the flip side of that, though, an attendant at the Interfaith shelter where Harris was staying testified that Harris was at the shelter on December 4th and therefore couldn't have committed the last attack attributed to him. Harris was arraigned a week later on December 21st. He pled not guilty and he was bound over for trial. In addition to the victim identification, a 12-year-old girl identified Harris as the man she'd seen at the convenience store near one of the victim's homes around the time of one other attack. Cat hair matching one of the women's cats was found on Harris's jacket, and there were similarities in the chemistry of Harris's blood and seminal fluid found at one of the scenes. Remember, though, this is 1982. DNA testing is not a thing yet. That's still a few years off. So when we say matching cat hair was found, that just means that there were matching patterns on the cat hair on Harris's jacket and the hair on the victim's cat. And when we say there were similarities in the chemistry of Harris's blood and the attacker's seminal fluid, said chemistry is equally similar in about 25% of the population. So if the chemistry wasn't a match, it could have excluded Harris. But the fact that it was a match certainly did not on its own point to his guilt. It was just one piece of a much bigger puzzle. The biggest and most important piece, though, was the identification from his victim. She testified that he'd walked past her house several times the day of the attack while she was washing her windows, so she got a good look at him more than once. She went back into her house and into her bedroom and turned around to find the man standing in her doorway. So she got another, this time very up close, look at him before he attacked her. The cat hair and the blood test were just kind of supportive details, not something you could make a whole case out of, right? On Friday, April 1st, 1983, Michael Harris was found guilty of all charges. The following day, he attempted suicide in his jail cell. He had fashioned a noose out of strips torn from his mattress cover, but it was unable to support his weight when he tried to hang himself with it. He was transferred to the Ypsilanti Regional Psychiatric Hospital, which is where he was when a judge sentenced him to 60 to 90 years in prison. But before they could lock the 20-year-old up and throw away the key, they had to send him up to Lansing, because by that point, he'd been charged with the murders of Ula Curdy and Denise Swanson, which were the last two in Lansing that were being contributed to this same killer. After authorities matched Michael Harris's fingerprints to those found on a chair at Ula Curdy's house, he was charged with her murder. Harris had actually been questioned in the days following Ula Curdy's murder. By that point, he'd already been a suspect in Edna Reichert's murder and was on probation for breaking into two elderly women's homes over the summer. He told authorities that on the day of the murder, he walked up to the Burger King on West Saginaw in Delta Township to pick up his paycheck, then walked to the Lansing Mall, then back home. Police didn't even look into his story at the time, because if they had, they would have found that Michael Harris never even worked at Burger King. So he gave them an alibi and they just took it without looking into it at all. Harris's trial on second-degree murder charges for the death of Ula Curdy began in September of 1983. He was convicted by a jury and sentenced to life in prison, with the major piece of evidence against him being a palm print found at the scene on the seat of a chair near Ula Curdy's body. His trial for the second-degree murder of Denise Swanson began in October of 1983. This time, there was no jury, just a judge. The primary piece of evidence centered around the knife that was used to cut Swanson's throat, although those injuries were not what killed her. Harris's fingerprints were found on the cardboard packaging the knife had been in. Both the bloody knife and the packaging were left at the scene. What's more, code markings on the packaging indicated that the knife had come from the Delta Township ShopRite, where Harris worked. So he worked. If you're familiar with West Lansing, the ShopRite in Delta Township and the Burger King in Delta Township were not far apart. Why he lied and said he worked at Burger King instead of just saying, I walked to ShopRite, I don't understand that, but that's what happened. Judge Robert Holmes Bell found Michael Harris guilty, and he gave him another life sentence. He was sent to the Muskegon Correctional Facility to spend the rest of his natural life, which was fitting because he was originally from Muskegon. There was not enough evidence to charge him in any of the other murders or attacks, but he remained the prime suspect. And then DNA happened. With the development of DNA testing being used as evidence at trials in the late 80s and early 90s, we saw a lot of what's happening now with the more recent development of ancestral DNA testing. We're seeing all of these cold cases all of a sudden go through testing that we were not able to do on not just suspects, but their relatives. There was a similar and arguably bigger boom of cold cases coming out of the freezer when DNA testing first became a thing. Prosecutors hoped to use this development to close the cases where they knew who their guy was but couldn't prove it. Meanwhile, wrongfully convicted prisoners saw it as a beacon of hope. If they could get the courts to test DNA in their cases, they could finally prove their innocence beyond just saying, "I didn't do it." Oddly enough, both Michael Harris and the detectives working the cold cases he was suspected of were eager to run evidence through the DNA ringer, and everybody started pushing for DNA testing in the outstanding cases. Authorities were sure it would prove his guilt, and Michael Harris seemed sure it would prove his innocence, which he had been insisting upon since his arrest. Somehow, it did a little bit of both. The first evidence to be tested with that newfangled DNA technology was evidence from the unsolved Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor murders of Florence Bell, Marjorie Upton, and Louise Kobnick. Seminal fluid and or DNA evidence found under fingernails and elsewhere on scene was collected and preserved, as this big breakthrough in DNA testing was coming in the very near future and law enforcement agencies knew it. So, this happened, these murders happened close enough to the development of DNA testing that authorities were saving this type of evidence, waiting for the science to catch up. In all three cases, Michael Harris's DNA matched DNA collected from the crime scenes. Detectives even took things a step further before charging him with these additional murders, however. They weren't satisfied with the fact that their DNA evidence from the scene matched his DNA profile from the Lansing cases. So we've got his DNA in the system now from the Lansing cases. They've got the DNA from these old cases. There's a match, but they say, nope, let's just get a new DNA sample from him to be sure. So in January of 2001, nearly 20 years into Harris's prison term, they served a search warrant on his cell to collect DNA evidence. Among the items they took was a pornographic magazine called Over 50. Michael, stop it. On Thursday, December 20th, 2001, 38-year-old Michael Harris, who'd been in prison almost half his life at this point, was charged with the murders of Florence Bell, Marjorie Upton, and Louise Kobnick, nearly two decades after they were committed. Now, you might think, other than providing victims' loved ones with a sense of justice and answers, what would be the point of charging someone already serving multiple life sentences with additional murders? Well, there was one. Because as we all know, life doesn't mean life, and Michael had reached the stage in his incarceration where he was eligible for parole every few years. And if you think parole would never be granted to a serial killer, you are wrong, my friends. I can think of two local cases right off the top of my head. Brent Koster, who helped Danny Raines kill and murder multiple young women back in the 70s, was released a few years ago on parole and now isn't even on parole anymore. So he's in his 60s, just out there living among us with no oversight whatsoever. And do not give me that he did his time bullshit. That does not apply to serial killers. And let's not forget Donald Miller, who murdered four women in Lansing and East Lansing back in the 70s. He's only serving time at this point for getting caught with a weapon in his cell, and he's going to be released in 2031, if not before. He's also not that old. He just turned 70, which is not as old as it sounds now that I'm pushing. I'm not even going to say it. Now that I'm getting older. So anyway, Michael Harris was having dreams of freedom after spending almost 20 years in prison, either through exoneration or parole, and authorities were hoping to finally be able to give grieving families some answers. Harris was only tried for the murders of Marjorie Upton and Louise Kopnik. The Florence Bell case was supposed to go third, but after he was convicted of the first two, it was deemed that four life sentences, so he's got Denise Swanson, Ulla Kirti, Louise Kopnik, and Marjorie Upton, four life sentences was enough, and another trial would just be overkill when they already knew that he was guilty, right? So in April 2003, Michael Harris was sentenced to life for the first-degree murder of Marjorie Upton. In December of 2003, he was given his fourth life sentence for the first-degree murder of Louise Kopnik. With first-degree murder convictions, he was now no longer eligible for parole, the way that the second-degree murder charges for Ulla Kirti and Denise Swanson allowed for. Are you following me? This is so many people. That's the thing about serial killers. There's so many victims, it's hard to keep track of. So he's now been convicted of multiple attacks, but four murders. Two in Lansing, Ulla Kirti and Denise Swanson, which he got life sentences for, but they were both second-degree murder charges, so he was eligible for parole. But now he's been convicted also of two murders in Ann Arbor Ypsilanti, the Marjorie Upton and Louise Kopnik. So four murders, four life sentences, donezo. Done, right? No. It's not over yet, friends. Michael Harris continued to maintain his innocence as he'd always done. He filed every appeal he could, often representing himself, accused authorities of planting evidence and falsifying results. And then in 2015, he asked an Ingham County judge to order DNA testing on some of Ulla Kirti's clothing, which was never done because DNA was not a thing in 1983. So, and again, Ulla Kirti is one of the murders he's already been convicted of. He's convicted on primarily a palm print of his on the scene of the crime. Now he wants them to test DNA. So the judge ordered the testing and the results threw the entire case against Michael Harris into a tailspin. Because not only did the DNA not match his, it matched someone else with a DNA profile in CODIS. So not just a random DNA profile, but another inmate or former inmate. And this wasn't just any old DNA sample. It was seminal fluid on Ulla Kirti's clothing that belonged to a male who wasn't Michael Harris. According to the Ingham County prosecutor, as soon as their office was notified of the results, they obtained Michael Harris, a court-appointed attorney, opened an investigation into how all of the DNA testing in his case was handled, and ordered retests on the Ulla Kirti evidence. Michael Harris's Wikipedia page very wrongly states that in the mid-2010s, DNA testing proved that he was not responsible for any of the murders. And that's not, first of all, DNA evidence was not used in any of his Lansing or Jackson convictions, okay? He was picked out of lineups by victims and other witnesses. His prints were found at two of the scenes. There was a mountain of circumstantial evidence. If the DNA evidence had been used to secure his conviction and it was no good, then yeah, I would say that warrants a new trial at the very least. But the fact that someone else's DNA was present doesn't mean that he's not guilty. It just means that someone else might be also. Maybe he had an accomplice. Maybe he knew there was a chance that his accomplice's DNA would be found if the evidence was tested, and that's why he asked for DNA testing on the Ulla Kirti evidence specifically and only. Or maybe there was an error at the lab. Things like that should not happen, but they do. There was cross-contamination or just the wrong profile got attached to the results, something like that. That would be grounds to throw out the DNA sample completely as evidence, for sure. But the DNA sample was never used as evidence to begin with. So in this case, the conviction would stand. I love a good conspiracy theory. I really do. But I also believe that where there's smoke, there's fire, right? unqualified opinion time, but even if a retest yields the same results, it doesn't really change anything aside from maybe adding an additional killer to the mix. But it doesn't take Michael Harris out of the equation. It doesn't change the fact that these murders followed him around the state. When he would move, the murders would stop in the place he'd left and start up in his new city. It doesn't change the fact that multiple people picked him out of lineups, that he admitted to breaking into the homes of elderly women in Lansing during the time that these crimes were being committed, that he lied about his alibi in the Ula Kurdi case, that his fingerprints were found at two of the crime scenes, that his DNA was found on three of the victims, that three different police departments investigated him and found forensic evidence against him, that he had jury trials and judge-only trials in three different counties, and in every case, he was found guilty. He got kind of a charcuterie board of the criminal justice system, and it all added up to him being guilty. Some rando DNA spec on one piece of evidence, the very specific item that he fought for them to test, mind you. Tell me that's not suspicious. That doesn't take away from any of the rest of it. I'll compare my theory on this case to my theory on the Matthew Macon case. Do I think there is a snowball's chance in hell that Matthew Macon is innocent? No. I know there are people who think that, which is crazy. And to those people, I say, hit me up. I've got the video of his confession on my computer. I got it through a FOIA request. It leaves no doubt that the man is guilty. But do I think it's possible that someone else did some of it? Or that he had an accomplice? Absolutely. And I feel the exact same way about this case. Michael Darnell Harris is a serial killer. Did he have an accomplice? Maybe. Was someone else maybe responsible for some of the attacks that were pinned on him? Sure. But that doesn't change the fact that he is a serial killer. Okay. I feel better now. Thanks for letting me get that all out, guys. I'm over here talking like we don't know what happened with the DNA retest, and we absolutely do, because in 2017, results came in on the retest of the evidence in the Ula Kurdi case, and Michael Harris's DNA was found. As for what happened the first time around, no idea. Did the wrong results get attached to Michael Harris's profile? Did some cross-contamination happen in the lab? Maybe. Does it look hella suspicious that upon retesting, magically, his DNA was also there after all? A little bit, yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. And if this was the only murder he was convicted of, or if the DNA evidence had been used to convict him, I'd probably be singing a different tune right now. But when you look at the whole big fucked up picture, he is still a serial killer. Even if he didn't kill everyone they attribute to him, and remember, he's only actually been convicted of four of the murders. The rest, he's just the main suspect. Upon receiving the results from the second round of testing, I want to share with you what both the judge and the prosecutor had to say. The judge said that based on all of the evidence placing Harris at the scene, the jury got it right. And the prosecutor said, regardless of whatever happened with the Ula Kurdi case, freedom for Michael Harris anytime soon was highly unlikely given his extensive record. And I quote, if there was only one conviction for which he was serving time, his situation would change dramatically. That's what I'm saying. Now, I want you to just sit with that for a second. This is the judge and the prosecuting attorney. They're not armchair detectives like you and me. They actually went to school for this. They've got access to information and evidence and reports that we don't. And this judge and this prosecutor weren't involved in the initial cases, the initial investigations. They're coming in some 35 years after the initial conviction, trying to clean up somebody else's mess. So, do we trust them? Do we trust their judgment? And I want you to answer that question before I tell you who the judge and prosecutor were during the whole faulty DNA mess. The judge was Rosemarie Aquilina, who, while all of this was going on, was also presiding over the Larry Nassar trial, which will probably always be the case that she's known for. Like, we all put our faith in her, right? We all copied Natalie Portman and got our Judge Aquilina shirts. Well, maybe we didn't. All, but I, I did. We trusted her judgment on that. Do we trust her judgment on this? And the prosecutor was Big Gretch, Michigan's current governor, Gretchen Whitmer, who has a cult following all her own. All this was going down right as she was about to announce her first bid for governor. So you might think that it would make sense for two politicians with the aspirations these two women had at the time to want to minimize any government scandal, but I disagree. They didn't do this. It was all men that created this whole mess, from committing the crimes to prosecuting them to processing the evidence. It would have behooved both of these women to push the narrative of a wrongful conviction that they were going to set right, actually, right? That's what would have made the headlines, especially during such a pivotal time in both of their careers. You know what I mean? I need to stop rambling, but I do want to share this thought that occurred to me while I was researching this case. With how fiercely Michael Harris has always maintained his innocence and how many bumps in the road this case has had, I just know, like, I know that when the Matthew Macon murder started in 2007 with a young black man killing elderly white women who lived alone in the same neighborhoods and even on several of the same dates as the Michael Harris case, somebody somewhere was shitting their pants thinking, oh, fuck, we really did get the wrong guy, and now he's doing it again. Because it's weird enough that our city had one such out-of-the-box serial killer, but two? That is wild, friends. That is wild. Here is where I would like to take a big old deep breath and say, peace out, until next time. Instead, I say, but wait, there's more. In 2025... yep, last year, the Michigan Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life sentences for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds were unconstitutional, no matter their crimes, meaning that anyone in Michigan currently serving life that was sentenced between the ages of 18 and 20 has to have their case reviewed for resentencing. There were a lot of sentences in that sentence just now. Anyway, I know you guys are picking up what I'm putting down. Michael Harris was 18, 19, 20 at the time of these crimes. He fought his convictions, and he filed every appeal known to man. He still maintains his innocence. So, of course, he is gunning for a resentencing. And he just might get one. Is a known serial killer about to be released back onto the streets for murders he committed as a teenager? Does the key to keeping him locked up lie in these other cases, the ones he was never tried for? Is there more DNA that can be tested on these other women from these other cases? Other evidence that can be looked at with technology that wasn't available in 1983? Well, stay tuned, I guess. My source for today's episode was almost entirely old articles from the Lansing State Journal and other Michigan-based newspapers found on newspapers.com, as well as just a couple of online articles by the Detroit Free Press from 2016 and 2017 when all of this DNA retesting was happening. And now, I'm done. Thank you all so much for still being here, even though I kind of left you hanging there for a bit. And by a bit, I mean a couple years. I just needed some time to try to collect myself. And then I eventually came to the conclusion that there is no collecting to be done, and I just needed to accept my hot messness and get back to work, because I really have missed this medium of storytelling and connecting with you all in this way. So what's next? New episodes are going to be released twice monthly on the 1st and 15th of each month. This is so that I can team up with my true crime podcasting hero, Nina Instead, host of Michigan's OG true crime podcast, Already Gone, for coordinated release days. So henceforth, on the 1st and 15th of the month, you'll get a double dose of Great Lakes True Crime, a new episode of Already Gone, and a new episode of Michigan Monsters. Right now, Nina is doing an in-depth multi-episode piece on the Oakland County child killer in addition to her regular drops, so be sure to check that out. Both Already Gone and Michigan Monsters are available wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow me on Facebook and Instagram under Michigan Monsters Podcast. Leave me alone about Threads and X and Snapchat. Those are not for me. I'm too old. But I am on TikTok under It's Jen Carpenter. And there also is a new website for the show, MichiganMonstersPod.com. And that's it. That's all I've got for you today. I'll see you on the 15th. Until then, keep your doors locked, even during the daytime, because not all monsters hide in the dark.
Save big now during Menards Super Savings Sale. Brighten your home with a 3-panel LED light bulb. Now just $1.99. Stay warm with a hardwood firewood bundle. Only $3.99. Stock up with Clorox All-Purpose Cleaner. Just $2.99. A 16-pack of Zest Bar Soap is only $7.99. Hurry, these great deals won't last long. Sign up for Menards emails to get the weekly flyer plus exclusive daily flash sales right to your inbox. Save.